Ledger Bridge.
Okay, thanks. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the full task force meeting of the Information Blocking Group. We are excited to hear progress from each of the three sub-work groups today. So with that, we'll get started. Starting with roll call, Andy Trescott.
Present.
Michael Adcock.
Here.
Stephen Lane.
Here.
Cheryl Turney. Denise Webb.
Present.
Tasha Termut.
Here.
Erin Meary.
Good morning.
Arian Malik.
Good morning.
Great. Valerie Gray.
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Anil Jain.
Good morning.
Cynthia Fisher. You're on the Adobe. We'll maybe get her on the phone later. Lauren Thompson. John Kansky. And Denny McComb.
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Okay, I am going to turn it over to Michael to get us started with overview of the work group's progress to date.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our task force meeting. I guess this will be our second major task force meeting. I wanted to say good morning and happy Friday to everyone. I hope that the weather is improving wherever you are. I want to start off by saying thank you. Thank you to the members of the task force and all the individual work groups that are out working. There's been a lot of great discussion, a lot of progress that's been made. I'm very impressed with the progress that we've made up to this point. Wanted to thank the staff from ONC for keeping us on task and for making sure that we have done what we need to have done up to this point. I want to thank the folks from Excel as well for making sure that these calls all go well. There is a lot going on. I think we've had this will be our seventh call this week just out of this task force. So a lot of work going on, but I won't belabor that point. I'm going to guide us through the overview of the work groups just like we did last week. We're going to talk through work group 1, 2, and 3, talk through any proposed recommendations that we have out of those work groups. But again, that's just going to be informational for everybody. We won't do a whole lot of discussion during that point. It's just bringing everyone to the lead on what the work groups have going on. Then Andy and I will open it up and talk about some of the big picture and overarching issues that we've come up with this week from the individual work groups and just try to remind us of what we're trying to get done importantly, but also any of those big topics that we need to discuss, we'll discuss there. And also anything that you hear during the updates that you want to discuss, we can certainly discuss those as well. If we could move to the next slide, please.
Michael, comment?
Yes. Sure.
I'm assuming that in this process, we will also be identifying key items that we'll want you to include in the update to the HITAC next week, yes?
Certainly. We'll discuss that at the end. So if you'll note those when we're going through it, during that last, which is the most time that we have is in that last little bullet item of overarching issues. So, yes, we will discuss that during that time.
Perfect.
Thanks for the question. That's a great question. So here's the overarching charge for the task force. I don't know that we need to remind you of this, but you know what we're trying to get done and what we're doing, so we'll move to the next slide. So again, the draft timeline. One thing that I do want to point out here, and we'll kind of skate through this on the rest of them, but I know that we've been pushing really hard to try to get to the point of where we are now, which is draft recommendations for HITAC for next week. I just want to remind everybody, and Lauren mentioned this yesterday on the call, and Mark may want to speak up to this point, but this is basically a progress check for us. So we're going to present any draft recommendations that we have during the HITAC meeting next week, but that doesn't stop things. It's not like we have to be complete. There are, you know, we have one work group that's very close to being complete as far as what the work group progress needs to be, but we have two others that have a lot of content and still have some outstanding issues, and we'll talk about those today that we need to work through. We're going to continue to work through this even after the HITAC meeting. You can see on here that there's more than one presentation of recommendations to HITAC. So we've got a couple of meetings pretty close together, so we'll be able to discuss those, but we've got some time left on this. I know we've been pushing really, really hard to try to be complete, as close to complete as possible by this week. But just wanted to remind everyone that we do have some time left. There are still some issues left that we have to work through that are complex. If they weren't complex, we wouldn't be tasked with trying to look at them. So we still have time left on that. Next slide, please. So this is just the group one meeting schedule. We've had multiple meetings. We had two meetings each week. Next slide, please. So the topics discussed, we spent a lot of time talking about health information networks and exchanges. The one proposal that we had is when you look at those definitions, we think that the distinction between an HIE, capital HIE, should be clear. One of the discussion points that we had is whether the definitions would cover the broad scope of entities that such terms should cover based on the intent of cures. We want the definition of HIE and HIN to be broad enough to capture the intent of cures, but not so broad that it removes any other category from being necessary. Everybody should not fit into one category and not they should fit into the category that they are acting on at the time. So we have to make sure that we're working through that definition, and we are. We revised the definition of HIE to mean an individual or entity that enables, facilitates, or performs the access, exchange, processing, handling, or other use of electronic health information. If you look at the way that that proposal is compared to what is in the rule already, we added a few pieces as far as facilitating and looking at processing and handling instead of just access and exchange. We also removed some language at the end that was, to the work group, very vague. It had possibly, and some other pieces in there, limited scope, limited group. It wasn't very clear, so we removed some of that. We will revisit that definition again in the work group next time we talk, but that's what we're looking at right now. We're still working through the HIN definition. We are all been tasked with some homework to look through that on our own and try to come up with some possibilities and some proposals. The electronic health information definition proposal, add text in the preamble that clarifies information is inclusive of human or machine readable form. And this is something that Andy discussed and others agreed with, brought up from actually real world examples, so that we make sure that information is clear, that we're not just talking about something that can be read by a human. We're talking about stuff that could be considered data in previous forms. We don't want to be there to be any loopholes for things being left out of information blocking. So that'll go in the preamble instead of the definition, just so that we make sure we're clear. Pricing information, we had a lot of discussion around pricing information. The consensus that proposed definition of EHI should be read to include pricing information. We're going to review ONC's RFI regarding price information and provide more detail about the scope and parameters of price information that would be included and the implications of including such information in the definition. Another piece of the discussion that we had, and it could very well be on the next slide, I'm not really sure, but a big part of that discussion was around unintended and intended consequences and the overall cost of, you know, including pricing information in this rule. So we are looking at that. We are having discussions further around that. This will be one of the issues that we discuss in our overarching issues. Next slide, please. So that's the end of group one. A lot of great conversation. The definitions, I think a lot of people thought that the definitions might be a little bit easier than potentially the exceptions, but I'll tell you, after sitting in that group for four phone calls now, it's not. There are a lot of things that we have to be very careful of. We know that And part of that is because we know that providers can act as health information exchanges or can be a part of that. We know that HIEs and HINs sometimes are confused. So there's a lot of discussion around definitions. But group two is the exception group. Again, lots of great work going on. We've had multiple calls on that one as well. Lots to discuss. Again, making good progress. We've had lots of great discussion. Next slide, please. So we talked a lot about promoting the security of EHI. We proposed that they clarify documentation requirement for when the practice does not implement an organizational policy. We had consensus around that when the requester is the data subject or patient, then security is no reason to prevent sharing unless there is a legitimate doubt of the identity of the patient, determining whether the current drafting requires a proposed recommendation. So as long as we know it's the patient, there's no reason that we should not share that information based on security. Again, only if there's a concern about who the patient is and that we can't confirm that that's who, that the identity of the requester is actually the patient. responding to requests that are infeasible. We had a lot of discussion around the meaning and application of providing a reasonable alternative. So one of the pieces in there is that there must be a reasonable alternative. It is if it's deemed infeasible. It can't just be that you don't want to do it or that you want someone else to do it. It has to be a truly, it has to meet multiple criteria. The group thinks that the requirement that the actor timely respond is unclear. Anytime you see just timely respond, that is left up to interpretation. So we're trying to look at determining whether or not we need to propose a revision or clarification to that particular point. Next slide, please. The licensing of interoperability elements on RAND terms. So we had, a great deal of discussion around this. A lot of this was on timeframes, but we did have a lot of discussion. We propose that we add the requirement that licensors must publicly post contact info for requesters to contact them, and requirement that requesters must use that publicly posted list to contact the licensors. And the confusion around that is, you know, if you have only a certain amount of time from the time that you're contacted, there's one thing to contact a public number or your media contact or your public affairs office. It's another to contact the person that can actually do something about that concern. So, and that there's a responsibility that falls on both parties there, one that whoever is receiving that request has to post who should receive it, and then again, whoever is contacting them must use that publicly posted list to contact the licensors, or it does not kick off that time frame. We determine that the 10-day response period in A is unreasonable for offering license. To try to get from request to license in 10 days, I don't know what organizations everyone works in, but I can tell you in anyone that I've ever worked in, 10 days is nearly impossible. So we're looking at proposing an alternate time frame. The other proposal is to build in time frame for licensor to acknowledge receipt of request in the overall response timeline. So instead of just ignoring it or waiting until the actual license estimate or quote is put out, we want to suggest that we potentially 72 hours to acknowledge that receipt so that you know whoever's requesting knows that the request has been received by the correct person and that the process has started. We're considering a proposal to clarify the scope of rights, and we did not get through this entire inception. It was a very large exception, and we will continue to work through that. Next slide, please. So that's the end of work group two. Work group three, conditions and maintenance of certification. Again, lots and lots of conversation around this. I will say that this work group is probably the closest to having draft recommendations. And if I'm not mistaken, this is one that we don't have. We had a meeting late yesterday afternoon. I don't think we have all the updates on the next slide, but I'll walk through them as much as I can. Next slide, please. So the topics that we discussed. Under assurances, we propose that the three-year retention period for products that are withdrawn. Also, that ONC should retain records on the chapel indefinitely for ongoing references, which products were certified over which time period. The discussion around that, and Andy can certainly chip in if he wants to, was around if a provider happens to be a part of a lawsuit or something like that happens, but he says that he was part of a certified EHR at that time, but there are no records to show that it was certified at that time, that could cause issues. And, you know, turning things off after 3 years could be an issue. We want to revisit TEFCA RFI to make recommendations when the revised draft of TEFCA is published, or have the other task force address it, either one, because there was a TEFCA task force. Once the proposal comes out or the draft comes out, we need to revisit that because we can't really revisit it at this point. Under communications, we had a lot of discussion. We want to clarify, this is a proposal, we want to clarify that administrative functions could be non-user-facing aspects. We want to determine how to address the issue, possibly through functional definition or examples in the preamble. We want to make sure that, you know, those administrative functions that really don't have anything to do with the user-facing aspects, that we have some way of making sure that those don't necessarily fit under information blocking. Second proposal under there is unintended consequences of fair use and other usages should be further explored by ONC. We feel that there's concerns about risk to vendor intellectual property that the task force wishes to be sensitive to. We do not wish to impinge upon innovation. That's one point that came up over and over again, and it's a great point. We don't want to slow down innovation, and if fair use isn't clearly defined as it pertains to this, that there could be unintended consequences. If one of the examples was about someone writing a scholarly article that included screenshots and other pieces of multiple EHR vendors' products, and then once somebody else got that, using it under something that would not be fair use. So we just need to explore that further and make sure our ONC needs to explore that further. We also want to draw a distinction around the purpose of using regarding screenshots. So we want to make sure that the purpose is clear. We're still determining the details of that proposal. We don't have the proposal finalized on that one yet. Next slide, please. Again, we're continuing communications. We had lots of proposals under this one. Lots of discussion again. We want to clarify via a list which third-party content might appear in a screenshot. Enumerating elements per screen is not feasible. There's just too much going on there. Next proposal there is to eliminate the two-year time frame for contract amendment and propose update at next renewal. So that's something that we saw trying to, and Andy brought an example up of this one. You know, if his company went through and had to meet a two-year timeline to update, to amend every contract that they had going on, it would have required like four additional attorney FTEs. So it just wasn't feasible. We want to look at that around contract amendment time, but also make sure that people have a plan, that there's a plan developed on how they're going to do that within a certain time period, and then that it gets done within another time period. So we're still working through that. That's some of the stuff that didn't make it that we discussed yesterday. Next proposal, unintended consequences of fair use and other usages. We discussed that already. Create a third communication bucket for unprotected communication. Examples of that are false communications, attorney-client privileges, et cetera. We feel that that's important. Enforcement. The proposal is to make sure that we use both email and certified mail for notices, initiating direct review, potential nonconformity, suspension, proposed termination, and termination. So there's a very defined process for, you know, where a developer is in that. But we need to make sure instead of just emailing we feel that this is important enough, especially if it leads to a ban, that we use not just email but also certified mail. As far as the ban, we had a good bit of discussion around that. We talked about whether appropriate to list the ban that is lifted. One of the proposals that we came up with there, and it's not on here, that companies that have a ban imposed on them, that even once they clear it up, they can clear it up as quickly as possible, but even once they clear it up, that it's listed on the chapel indefinitely. And the purpose of that is to make sure, and it would be listed not as active, but actually the dates of the ban, but that it would be listed so that, and this is a recommendation, it would be listed so that anyone that's looking for that would be able to find, okay, well, this developer was banned during this time period. It's over now. You know, it's an information point so that we have, as consumers and as, you know, people potentially looking for some of those developers' products, that we have a place to go and look and see if something's been banned, and if it was banned, that it was cleared up. We talked a good bit about self-developers. I won't read that whole, but call out an exception to proposed communications for self-development systems so that communications by health IT users aren't restricted by virtue of being an employee of the same company doing the development. So what we're asking for here is that, you know, if a hospital or a health system develops its own software, that the users of that software aren't restricted just because the hospital developed or the company that they work with developed that software. Users shouldn't be held under that. So next slide. That may be the end. Okay, so that was the end of that. And again, there were some things that we talked about yesterday under Task Force 3 that may not have made it because it was so late and we had to get the slides out in plenty of time for the public meeting today. But again, I want to thank the work groups for all the hard work, and, you know, not saying that that's the end of the hard work. There's still lots of work left to do, but certainly there has been an amazing amount of discussion and points. And the one thing that I do appreciate is everyone, even though we've had differing opinions, shown nothing but the utmost respect and professionalism as we've discussed those. I think that there are lots of groups that could learn from that, being able to have differing opinions and still discuss them, you know, in a manner that is respectful. So it's been great. It's been an honor talking about those, and I open it up to Andy to talk about anything I've missed, and then potentially move on to the next point, which are the overarching.
Anything you miss? I don't think you've missed a thing there, but Mike, thanks ever so much for that. I'm hoping that members who are on the call, you can see how the deliberations that you've been involved in are manifesting themselves now in the broader communications of the group of where we're at to. Now, as everyone's aware, we're moving into the phase now of actually, you know, pulling together our deliberations and our thinking into consolidated proposed recommendations for the task force to make to HITACT. And I really, really want to encourage you and urge you all to log onto the Google Docs, to get down and scribe what you think the recommendation will be, look what other people are doing, and update so we have a single view across your work group, which we'll then be discussing in the work group calls as we go forward over the next few days. That's the process that Mike and I put in place, and that's the one that we want to stick to. It's proving pretty dynamic and pretty good and resilient right now. I think we're putting together some really good recommendations, which are well thought out. So enough of my loquaciousness on that. So there's two key thoughts that I just want to discuss as a team. One is around the concept of simplification, and it's kind of an ongoing and emergent theme that's coming out of all the work groups right now. The rules are complex. You know, they are complex in their instantiation and in manifesting 21st century cures. They, I think it's, I'm going to try and channel Dr. Lane here. When Steve goes, you know, it's all about the ands and the ors. And we sit there on Steve's work group and we highlight all the ands and the ors in these nested paragraphs just to work out exactly what this really means. And where we can simplify, I'd like us to encourage that. I think that these regulations will get read, reread, and interpreted, and removing as much ambiguity caused by verbose draftsmanship as possible. I think that will be a good thing for us to do. And we all recognize, given our positions in the market and in the broader health ecosystem, that making things simple, easy to digest, and easy to implement is very, very important. And it's going to make some of the difference between confusion and ignoring of information blocking obligations versus adherence and actually demonstrably improving the benefits we deliver to our patients and their healthcare because of it. Team, what do you think around the simplification premise? I'm opening this up to the floor. And I'm astonished if no one's got anything to say.
John, Andy,
don't make me pick on somebody.
You know, Andy, it's John Kansky, if I could chime in.
Hey.
Absolutely agree. I mean, I think we had a robust discussion in our work group where on the one hand, absolutely correct, is that we want this regulation to achieve the desired end of more fluid information across the healthcare system on behalf of patients as well. On the other hand, any vagueness or fuzziness or lack of clarity only makes it harder for those who are going to seek to understand how to comply with the regulation, whether they're subject to the regulation, and then fuzziness and confusion is also going to, I believe, has the potential to lead to a lot of necessary claims of information blocking that are going to need to be adjudicated. And none of that it's not the goal of the regulation to create create the need to adjudicate a bunch of information blocking claims. The goal of the regulation is to make sure no one is information blocking. So the degree to which we can simplify and achieve clarity, whether it be in the definitions, in the requirements of the regulation itself, that will serve to have a more effective, precise regulation in the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Hey, this is Ariane. So one thing that I was expecting to see in the NPRM and didn't is the either a formal safe harbor or practices that would be considered reasonable under information blocking provisions, and at least would create a presumption of non-information blocking. And in particular, you know, I was expecting to see some tie between the in the NPRM to the TEFCA and to practices that would constitute information sharing that could be potentially simpler to comply with. So, you know, I share the premise that the current exception-based approach to information blocking regulation just creates a significant amount of complexity. So I absolutely endorse approaches to simplify it. One way to simplify it is to outline or enumerate a set of practices, is to enumerate the opposite. So right now we've got exceptions that if you don't meet one of the exceptions, you're an information blocker. I think it'd be useful to outline a set of actions that if you comply with them, you you at least have a and I hate to use the word safe harbor because I know it's a legal term and I know it's a regulatory term. But you'd at least, if you comply with those actions, be presumed to not be information blocking.
Hey, and Aaron.
Yeah,
Aaron,
I just
want to jump in. Sorry. Go ahead, Cynthia.
Go ahead.
I was just going to note that there is a request for information about the common agreement in the rule. That's all I want to know.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, 17402.
Yeah, this is Cynthia. I think John said it very well, and I applaud John for his articulate way of conveying the need to be for clarity. And I would say that I think the drilled down exceptions keep it to a narrowness, but I do think the intention of 21st Century Cures and the information blocking rules was to cast the net far and wide and keep it broad so that there is accountability. So I get concerned when a request for safe harbor comes up because, you know, the whole issue here is compliance of pushing the information to the patients that can be shared across systems with their providers and caregivers. So I think John, I agree strongly with and said it well, of looking at just being as clear as we can on the terms and definitions as we provide, as we move forward.
Thanks, Cynthia. So John's got his hand raised. John, do you want to say something more?
Yes, please. So this is a bit of an Aryan-inspired comment. What I said earlier was a little bit vague, and I'm trying to offer more concrete suggestions about how to simplify. You know, Aryan's talking about safe harbor to the extent that we can describe those things that will simplify the regulation. I think it would simplify compliance with the regulation in some cases where we can offer additional examples. For example, in the preamble, there's some examples of things that might implicate information blocking. That was super helpful. One of the suggestions that came up in our work group was, is it possible to suggest organizations that meet the definition of the four different actors and some examples of organizations that don't meet any of the definitions of an actor, just to help organizations trying to figure out how and if the how to comply with the regulation. Thank you.
That, yeah, thanks, John. And actually, that brings me neatly, sorry, Aaron, I'll just jump in there. that brings me neatly onto actually one of the points I wanted to discuss further, and that is around the scope of this. And there is a continued focus across all the work groups in ensuring that the spirit of the 21st century cures is carried on through the recommendations that we're making into the regulation. And one topic which has come up in every work group in some way, shape or form is the who do these regulations apply to? Now, over in definitions, we're talking about what's an HIE, what's an HIN, what's a provider, what's a health IT developer, where do they overlap, all that kind of stuff. And that's an intricacy. But in general, the basic premise, and some of the work group members have sort of raised this a few times, said, do we really mean that actually these regulations should apply to any organization? And I'm paraphrasing slightly here from the regulations. So any organization that's handling, processing, using, exchanging patient identifiable information. And the general sentiment I'm hearing, and I want to make sure that myself and Mike are able to reflect the sentiment across the task force back to the broader HITACH, which is where we're going to need to present these recommendations to, is that actually, yes, we as a group do believe that the manifestation of 21st century cures in these regulations is meant to touch and impact upon any individual or organization or other entity who is in some way processing electronic health information, as we define. And I just wanted to get that out there for the group to discuss as a whole about whether we as a group do believe that or not.
I've got my hand raised.
He's got his hand raised, so I'll let him in first.
Okay. So just first of all, on the notion of a safe harbor, what I have in mind would be, for example, with respect to patient access, if I host an API that allows the totality of information to be accessed by any patient at any time with reasonable identity assurance, that would be, for example, one of those activities that would qualify or that would be presumed compliant. With respect to the question you just raised, I think one way of getting at that, and that I tried to do in the sub-work group or sub-task force, is to paint some extremes around the edges and ask ourselves the question of, do we think that that is a health information network under cures that is subject to the seven exceptions or subject to information blocking and must comply with the seven exceptions? And so, I've poked around the edges at a bank. Is a bank an organization that, because it sends remits electronically with an identifier number that ties back to a claim that ties back to PII, are all banking transactions in healthcare associated with payment for procedures rendered and for claims, health information network subject to information blocking provisions? And I'm doing this as a way just to like poke around the edges and create some of these cases. Is a clearinghouse a health information network? Is a billing service a health information network? Is a records retention organization that digitizes records a health information network? And the answer could be yes or no, but I think it's useful to create some of the edges, some of the boundary cases, and adjudicate this on the notion of boundary cases, because it's easy to say the definition should be broad. We may have a different conclusion if we actually poke at some of those exceptions or some of those edge cases.
So thanks, Ari. And that's why I'm trying to have this, stimulate this conversation across the group by talking about the function. So do we believe as a group that these regulations should be applying to any individual entity organization who is processing, exchanging, handling, whatever verb you want to use, electronic health information.
And again, to my point, do we think a bank, the Health Information Network, that should be subject to this regulatory framework?
Yeah, I don't want to get into Health Information Network, Health Information Exchange, any of those definitions of subtypes of actors. I just want to say, in terms of the function, is that what we believe as a group? And John Kansky's got his hand raised. John.
Thanks, Andy. So, like Arian, I've been trying to think about the boundary cases to make sure that this holds water. On the surface, philosophically, it's very easy, and I think you're suggesting this, Andy, to say, well, yes, of course, why would we want anybody to be carved out of this? But I think there's clearly, the way the definitions of the actors are written, there's going to be lots and lots of organizations, types of organizations pulled into this that go beyond the intent of Congress. Now, I'm not Congress, but I'm trying to extrapolate. When you write a definition that's called Health Information Network, and then you realize that a physician practice can be an HIE, or a bank can be an HIN, or Lyft or Uber, a taxi cab company can be a healthcare provider, is that really what you're expecting in terms of a regulatory burden to place on the system? So I don't have an answer for you except to say, Andy, that I'm very nervous about the broadness of the definitions and the burden of the regulation that's going to be created.
I am too, and the burdensome nature will mean inevitably that non-compliance happens, and it just becomes a nightmare then to police because there is so much non-compliance, and it's just a domino effect, which is why I want to have this conversation, because the regulations, yes, we have some boundaries around some of the actors right now, but they are pretty broad. And thanks for the sentiment from yourself. Sasha, if you've got your hand raised.
Yes, so I wanted to, I guess, continue maybe Arian and John's suggestion of bringing up some of the scenarios that came up in Task Group 3 that also made us question exactly if the definitions were working as intended. One of our task group members, Les, to give fair credit, pointed out that some of these provisions, including about electronic health information and sharing it, for example, with the patient themselves, could have presumably unintended consequences on clinical research. Les brought up the scenario that if a patient is participating in a clinical trial, information about the patient's participation in the clinical trial would presumably be electronic health information. It would seem to meet that definition. But the sort of inclusion of that information to a patient would potentially invalidate the ongoing results and data being gathered as part of that clinical trial. That's kind of what the patient signs up for when they decide to participate. And so that was one example that came up in our task force. We were thinking about the export patient, the electronic health information export provision, when that example came up. But I think thinking about some of those cases helps us decide, as we're sort of thinking through, where do these definitions fall and if they are incorporating the right things in too much one way or another.
Thank you, Sasha. I agree. That's good input. Anybody else?
So this is Denny. I'm sorry I didn't raise my hand, but I'm thinking even of companies kind of even closer to healthcare that it doesn't seem like would be subject to these rules as they're written, like companies that are contracted to abstract charts for reporting to the state cancer registry. They certainly would have electronic health information to do their job, but it doesn't even seem like they have authority to be releasing or sharing that information. You see what I mean? Company that was contracted to
absolutely. And that's why we need to make sure that the exceptions are well constructed. That, you know, it wouldn't be reasonable for them to be where you go to accuse them of information blocking because of the purpose of what they do. I agree with you. And we need to make sure the regulations, you know, suitably allow for that. Alan Miri, has your hand up.
Yes, I do. Oh, thank you. So I also want to voice some concern about the way the rule is written and to the degree that it relates to substance abuse and mental health information and sharing of that data. As you know, there's a litany of additional states' privacy rules that are in effect, especially like where I am in Texas, that explicitly forbid transmitting that information against the patient's wishes, and it has to be at the direction of the patient. So to the degree that this rule conflicts a little bit to understand and deal with or remediate and standardize those processes, I would be in favor for.
Thanks, Alan. What I'll do is I'm going to ask Mark Nee, who's supporting us from RNC, offline, if you can actually get some thoughts together around the precedents, just so we can give a single paragraph back to the broader task force around, you know, where that would sit with precedents, et cetera, with state legislation. Cynthia, you had your hand up first.
Yes, thank you, Andy. I just think as we look through the suggestions that have just come up on comment, whether it be research or other patient information, I do think the intention is to provide relevant medical, clinical, and price information to the patient that is relevant to them receiving the best of care and quality of care, and share that it would impact improved health and improved diagnoses decisions in combination with their provider. So I think that it should be very well considered because we know that there's a lot of big data aggregated in many different ways behind the scenes on patients, and yet the patients don't have access to relevantly manage their life or their care or their decision. So I just think as we look at this, we really need to be well thought through and considered about the deployment to the patient.
Thanks, Cynthia. Amian.
First of all, just to summarize maybe some of the themes or consensus, number one is just to double down on Cynthia's comment that the goal here is to provide greater access to patients and also greater access to information to improve care, improve payment and administrative operations, and other activities that are associated with healthcare transformation. So that we should really start with the high level principles, and then ask the question about whether the proposed regulatory framework A, serves that need, and B, significantly increases burden relative to in ways that would either undermine the need or overall burden the U.S. healthcare system. If I read the text of 21st Century Cures, the congressional text of 21st Century Cures, the discussion of a health information exchange or health information network is always in conjunction with provider or health information technology. I believe that the intent of Congress was to facilitate information exchange of particularly clinical information relevant for treatment, care, operations, and payment. But I do not believe it was the intent of Congress to regulate banks or even to regulate some of the other ancillary services around healthcare. You know, I think if it had been the intent of Congress, then Congress would have written the definition in ways that enumerated potential classes of organizations to clarify the intent. And then I think one of the clear consensus items coming out of this conversation, maybe with a little bit of dissent, is the notion that we have an obligation to simplify what it means to be compliant with information blocking in ways that facilitate information flow and reduce the burden of compliance. So as an example, one of the examples that I gave If, as a provider organization, I offer an API that allows access to the totality of health information contained about the patient, I make that API available to patients with reasonable identity assurance, and I make that API available to providers and payers in order to facilitate, you know, many of the actions that are associated or we're trying to drive in cures, that I should be presumed to be not an information blocker. Things that we can do there do a double duty of actually encouraging the kind of exchange that we want to see and reducing the overall compliance burden.
Okay, I mean, thank you so much. That's helpful input too. And thank you everyone that's commented so far. I think just one aside, when we're talking about simplification, there's a couple of different sides to this. One is where we want to simplify so that the, as you just outlined, Arian, compliance is as straightforward as possible. Right now, for our drafting that we're doing and our recommendations we're making to go to HITACT, to go to back to ONC, I am pretty focused on simplification of the language that we're using, so it's understandable what that compliance would be ahead of actually performing the compliance itself. Without further ado, we've gotten down to 20 past the hour. I'd like to take the opportunity to open out to public comment, please.
Great, thanks, Andy. And operator, can we please open the public line?
Certainly. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue, and you may press *2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. And just want to confirm, did we have Cheryl Kearney join us? I don't think so, but just want to be sure. Okay. Or Lauren Thompson? Okay. Operator, do we have anyone in the queue at this time?
We have no one in queue at this time.
Okay, I will give you guys 10 minutes back if there's anything you would like to wrap up on before next week.
Okay, Task Force, is there any other issues emerging that you'd like to cover off?
Do you, Andy and do you, Michael, have a clear sense of what of all this is going to be presented at HITACT next week?
A clear sense, it's becoming clearer. My proposal right now is, I think, I'm not quite sure exactly how long we get, but I will do a not too verbose description of the process we've undergone and where we're at in it. And then it is, I think, Mike and mine's intention to present certainly the key emerging themes from each work group. Whether we want to present the absolute recommendations, we've got them drafted, that might well be premature. But I think, and that's generally where my head is, and Mike and I haven't really discussed that in any depth. Mike, what do you think?
No, I agree with that. I think that we, I don't know how much time we get, maybe ONC can speak to that, but I agree with what you're saying. We need to walk through how we've broken this work up and the process that we've gone through and emerging themes. We have multiple other opportunities to make sure that the recommendations are presented to HITACT, presented to ONC. So I think that we should do exactly what Andy said right now. We have not discussed how, you know, what the cadence of that's going to look like or how the flow goes. We will be ready by our time to present for sure.
Cool. Is there anything particular that the task force would like us to raise before the HITACT at this point?
It should be a fun debate.
Yes. You know, frankly, it'll be good to get the input from the rest of HITACT anyway, and it will also be good to see what the other task forces have got to as well. You know, we hear rattles from the ONC staff, but it'll be good to see where they're at. I also intend at some point probably we should have a bit of a sidebar, at least as work groups, if not as a task force, just to touch base with each other outside the main meeting room while we're in DC as well, because we're all physically together. If that's okay with people?
Yep.
Okay, great. Look forward to seeing you in DC next week. Anything else? We'll give you 5 minutes back.
Thanks, everyone.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.